Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. California's population is nearing 40 million. Its economy is larger than every country except China, Japan, Germany, and the United States, of course. But the state also has enormous problems: housing and homelessness, economic inequality, and the impact of climate change. In a pair of articles for the New York Review of Books, Michael Greenberg explores the issue of immigration in California and the state's efforts to adopt political solutions that are often strongly opposed by the Trump administration. The first article, In the Valley of Fear, appeared in the December 20th issue of the NYRB, and California, the State of Resistance, was in the January 17th issue. I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Greenberg to our show now to discuss some of the leading economic and political issues facing California and how they relate to the United States as a whole. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
What do Californians say is the biggest problem facing their state?
Housing. Housing. They speak about housing more than they speak about Trump. And it's an obsessive issue in California because it really is an emergency crisis there. Almost a third of America's homeless are in California. And there's a popular belief that that's because people come to California because it's warm and it attracts the homeless. But this is not true. It's because of the cost of housing. They have a housing shortage that is really, it makes New York look like Sweden in comparison.
Across the state?
Across the state.
When I say across the state, obviously state is more vertical than horizontal. But up and down
up
the state?
Up and down, east and west, absolutely every city, there are homeless encampments. From Sacramento down to San Diego.
Hmm. Well, and the reason is simply that prices are high. Why are they high?
Well, California is an interesting contradiction of a state that is the most liberal, democratic state in the country. Registered Republicans are down to 25%, the lowest ever. And Democrats control every position of power statewide, yet it has a tremendous sort of far west idea of property rights and local micro local rights. So you have residents able to block housing in these micro neighborhoods and cities, and the state is powerless to do anything about it.
Isn't there also, what was it, Proposition 13?
Proposition 13 in 1978.
And its impact is still being felt?
Absolutely. Proposition 13 seems to be sacrosanct, although it was passed just simply as an initiative, a ballot initiative, yes or no. But it seems to be untouchable. And what it means is that property owners, homeowners, and also businesses who pushed Proposition 13, so commercial properties as well, are taxed only at the rate that they were purchased at. So if you've been in a house for 30 years and you bought it for $200,000 and it's now worth $1.8 million or $2 million, you're still paying that low base tax. So there's an incentive not to sell. Because if you rebuy, you're going to be at a higher tax, and it just creates a shortage. And it also has decimated the educational system because a lot of education, public schools, are paid for from property taxes.
So property taxes were frozen by Proposition 13. You described the new governor, Gavin Newsom, as progressive and then, quote, with a Machiavellian allegiance to developers and large landholders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that possible to be both? Why his allegiance to real estate in particular?
Well, it's the biggest power in California. And landowners in California and developers in California don't just have small properties. They can have 40, 50, 60,000 acres. Orange County, for instance, is owned, one-fifth of it, by one man, Donald Bren, who owns the Irvine Company. So these are property tracts
that... And owns Irvine, California, the city itself.
He owns the city, exactly.
Is there any other place in the United States where somebody actually owns a city? And this is a regular city. This is not a little town.
No, it's almost 300,000 people. It's growing quickly. I don't know of any city of that size. I think there are probably towns in Texas and things that are owned by single people. But this is incredible. And it's the Irvine Ranch, as it was known, was created right after the Gold Rush by a San Francisco family who bought it. It was a drought. A stricken tract of formerly Spanish land that nobody wanted, bought 90-something thousand acres, and it's still more or less intact today.
But you suggest that it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you're likely to somehow favor real estate developers?
It's very difficult.
I mean, we're having that problem here in New York to some degree with the Amazon move to Queens, where people are concerned that the city is giving money to Amazon, the wealthiest company. Isn't the wealthiest company in the world right now?
The wealthiest company in the world, yeah.
Certainly to come here because we hope to have jobs. Is this to some degree related to that sort of thinking in California?
I think it's slightly different because the city was able to override local concerns. In other words, the Amazon moved to Queens was not done was not approved by voters. It was done behind closed doors. This usually is not the case in California, where you do have. But I would say that you cannot run for statewide office without developers, without money from developers.
Well, Orange County was for a long time definitely a red enclave. But the last election, they voted Democrat in. So is that an indication of where California is going or where the Democrats are going in California?
I think so. The reason is that this is the home of Nixon, of the John Birch Society. This is the mythic Reagan country, Orange County, 3.5 million people, is now largely Hispanic and Asian, and I think a lot of Trump's rhetoric. And not only rhetoric, but actions, anti-immigrant actions, racist rhetoric, really alarmed even conservative Asians who generally will vote conservatively.
Who's living in Irvine? Because housing is expensive in Irvine, isn't it? Because people think that if they live there, they're living in a safe community, safe with quotes around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the schools are very good because they're supported by Donald Bren, the owner of Irvine. So
he bought it from the Irvine family.
Yes, he did. In the 1990s, he took complete control of it from the Irvine family, and he's the wealthiest real estate developer in the United States. And you can't find anything about him online. He's very, very close to the bone, extremely powerful, part of a power structure in Southern California that stretches into Los Angeles County as well. And it has the lowest crime rate. It's a completely planned city down to the way, to the type of construction that's allowed, the way it looks, mission architecture, certain types of high rises. It's in some ways, you could say, it's the perfect Jane Jacobs city. If you took Jane Jacobs to the ultimate, and she herself, I'm sure, would be appalled by it, but it does follow her idea, small village communities, little centers, mixed use with corporate headquarters, so people work and live there.
What about population diversity? Is it likely that any immigrants from Central America or or Mexico would be living there?
It's very unlikely. There's the city of Santa Ana, 5 miles away, which is majority 70% Hispanic. Irvine has Asian aspiring, wealthier, upper-middle-class Asians, a lot of new Chinese people who are coming from China now buying homes there.
Donald Trump has made immigration a major focus of his presidency with his insistence on building a wall. How concerned are Californians about immigration?
Californians are very sympathetic to the immigrant. I mean, especially to Mexicans and Central Americans. There's no Californian who hasn't had a tremendous amount of interaction, either middle class people with nannies or people at the supermarket. I mean, it has a huge Mexican population. It's ingrained in the culture and life.
And the food that people eat.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
But recently, President Trump praised San Antonio for its wall, and people in San Antonio point out that there's, I think, 150 or 200 miles away from the Mexican border. I'm assuming he actually meant San Diego. Is there a wall in San Diego, and are the people in San Diego in support of mending that wall and making it stronger?
Well, there is intermittent barriers, I think, around San Diego, near San Diego. I don't know. San Diego's a very conservative city, and I can't really speak for San Diego people, but I would think not. I would think the flow is very important to the economy and workers who come back and forth. So it's in general, California and even the California law enforcement people, police, state police, local police, have been supportive of California's sanctuary law, which doesn't allow ICE officials into jails to deport, to take out people who have been arrested and arraigned and deport them summarily. So that has been protective of immigrants, but it has also exposed immigrants, undocumented immigrants, to being plucked from the community. But we can talk about that also. It's an interesting situation.
Has California led the country in passing sanctuary legislation?
Yes, California has led the country in passing sanctuaries. California has led the country in immigration reform. California has led the country in benefits to immigrants, in assuring minimum wage. It's been very progressive.
The Trump administration and conservatives in general have strongly opposed the sanctuary laws there in New York and some other cities. How much effect is their opposition having on the laws in practice?
Well, the practice, it's very interesting because ICE is not allowed. ICE used to have immigration used to have a couple of jail cells in every county jail, and they, you know, the undocumented immigrants would be reserved for ICE, and they would not be in the jurisdiction of the local police. And this could be for things we're talking about, a DUI, an unpaid speeding ticket, disorderly behavior, loitering, small things, really misdemeanors and infractions. And ICE normally, formally, would go in, take those people, and deport them. Now they're not allowed to do that. California has been the leader in that. But ICE has responded very angrily and said, well, you're not going to let us into your jails. Then we're going to go into the community and start harassing undocumented immigrants. So this has created kind of a cordon of terror, especially in rural communities where farm workers, where economies are completely dependent on Mexican farm workers, undocumented, 90% of them. Where ICE is following people in schools when they pick up their kids. They're hanging out at their apartment buildings in marked and unmarked cars. And so the sanctuary law has prompted and provoked ICE to actually come down harder. So it hasn't worked to immigrants, undocumented immigrants, benefit?
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. I'm speaking with Michael Greenberg, whose articles in the Valley of Fear and California State of Resistance were published in the New York Review of Books recently. Are Latino voters, the citizens, turning out to vote?
Well, sometimes. In the November 2018 election, Latinos did turn out at a higher rate than before and were responsible for overturning some moderate Republicans, even in the San Joaquin Valley, which is traditionally. But in general, Latino voters have not voted in large numbers. And I think Latino voters have been turned off by some of the national rhetoric, and they feel that their vote doesn't matter.
Well, there's also been concern about voter suppression in the United States. Is Latino voter turnout suppressed in California in any areas?
California doesn't have a big problem in voter suppression, and in fact, they've been very progressive in redistricting. And not having intense gerrymandering. So they've been a leader in that as well. So it's not repressed. It's not voter suppression. It's a sense that California has a history of kind of being ahead of the United States in everything. And that's not always in a good way. Right now, it seems to be ahead in carbon emissions, where it's the absolute leader, in immigration reform and sanctuary law. But in the 1990s, in 1994, it was ahead in anti-immigrant laws. Mm-hmm. And it passed the most draconian anti-immigrant law in 1994 called Proposition 187 that disallowed immigrants to have any kind of benefit and even to go to schools. And so it's kind of the blueprint for the current anti-immigration policies of the Trump administration.
And do you think it's because of the Trump administration that attitudes have changed, or is this something that's been a long time coming just based on looking at the realities of California's economy?
Well, yeah, I think what happened with Proposition 187 is that it passed with 57% of the vote. It allowed a Republican governor, Pete Wilson, to get reelected, but it eventually was struck down by the courts, as is happening with Trump. It's a cautionary tale for Trump. It caused a flight from the Republican Party, and we can expect that this same thing is going to happen to the Republican Party nationally.
Texas is now facing court challenges to efforts to purge voters and it claims are not citizens, and civil rights groups contend that these voters have, in fact, become citizens. So to some degree, it's also a matter of whether somebody can prove that he or she has gone through the process to become a citizen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are, I think, 8.5 million undocumented Mexicans in the United States. Over a third of them live in California, so more than any other state by far, and they don't vote because they're undocumented. But it also has a huge citizen community, and not all Hispanic voters are left. There's a lot of overlap between conservative Republican policies and beliefs of a lot of Mexicans. Many are anti-abortion. Many approve of gun rights. So 25-30% by most estimates will vote Republican and will vote Trump.
One quarter of the Mexican immigrants.
At least.
Well, we see that among every group that we assume would feel it's discriminated against in this country. There's a sizable support, African-American support for Trump as well, including some members of Congress. So it depends on what's important to you. If guns or abortion are important issues to you, then then you'll wind up with a different political party than your neighbor.
Right.
Now, in the case of California, according to Forbes magazine, California has over 120 billionaires, which is compared to about 93 in New York State. Does that make everything in the state more expensive?
Well, it's the richest state by far, as you said in the introduction. Were it a sovereign country, it would be the fifth wealthiest in the world, ahead of the UK. Yes, it does make things more expensive. You have clusters of high-paying tech jobs around San Jose and Silicon Valley, and you don't have enough housing for that. Speaking of the Amazon question that you brought up, an interesting parallel to that is Google in San Jose, which has really just appalling housing prices and shortages, is building a 20,000 workforce campus right now. And the state is saying you need to build housing.
Yeah, well, where are they going to get the workers?
Exactly.
Are they going to bus them in from other parts of the state?
They do. They have Google buses. They come in from Oakland and stuff, and it's driven prices up across the north and the Bay Area into Fresno, into Sacramento. So it's people are commuting 2 hours.
To go to work. But since California's economy is so huge, isn't it strong enough to support solutions to the problems we're talking about?
We would think, we would hope, but in fact, it isn't, because almost all of its tax base, because of Proposition 13, because of the strangling of property taxes, almost its entire tax base is from income tax, from personal income tax, capital gains. You speak of you mentioned the 90-something billionaires in the state.
120 billion.
120 or 90-something in New York. My God.
We only have 93.
Oh, we have to catch up.
So we are supposedly the financial center of the country.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Silicon wealth is beyond anything that has been imagined in the United States prior, even the great robber barons. So a lot of that is from capital gains. 70% of California's taxes come from personal income tax, and 45% of that comes from the richest, I think, 0.5%. And a lot of that is capital gains. So when you have a stock market correction, California is very, even without a recession, California is very vulnerable to a quick and precipitous drop in revenues. And in a real recession, I mean, they can go into a deep deficit.
So how can that be redressed? Do they have sales taxes?
They have sales tax.
Well, they have local sales taxes.
Yeah, but sales tax never really raises enough. It has to be redressed by a reconsideration of its property rights-based anti-government. You know, Proposition 13, again, California was ahead of the country. That was the first anti-government movement. You know, no government. California is now trying to up its government and make its government more muscular, but it's working against old patterns. So California swings, and it really needs to increase its property taxes and make them more equitable and use that money for housing, for affordable housing. You have affordable housing being blocked by people who erroneously and dubiously feel it will drop the value of their property.
Interestingly, Jerry Brown was in office in 1978 when Prop 13 was voted in. Have even supposedly progressive leaders been weak on issues of inequality or economic justice?
Yeah, they have. They have. They've been. You know, it's the classic liberal, democratic a conundrum and sort of trap, which is progressive on cultural issues. I mean, Gavin Newsom, the current governor, was bravely supported gay marriage when he was mayor of San Francisco in 2003, I think. And so very progressive on individual rights.
And we had the same thing with Jerry Brown's successor, George Dukmanijian, a Democrat. He is accused of undermining organized labor despite the support he received from unions.
Yeah, well, he received more support from businesses than unions. And in fact, what he did was, as soon as he came into power, he pretty much dismantled the United Farm Workers Union after receiving a lot of support from growers, which Jerry Brown had increased their power, and he almost dismantled a state system of arbitration. So,
and is that still in effect?
It's very hard to unionize farm workers right now. United Farm Workers have gone from 70,000 members to 10,000. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One reason is because almost all farm workers today are undocumented. Remember Cesar Chavez, the great leader? He was an American citizen. He was born here. So the farm labor has shifted to undocumented. It's very hard to organize undocumented workers.
You refer to plantations on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. Are you suggesting parallels to slaveholding South?
Well, it has.
That was in your piece on the Valley of Fear, which is the San Joaquin Valley.
Yes. Well, you know, slaveholding, I don't know if I'd go that far, but you have plantations of 20, 30, 40,000 acres where fruits and vegetables and high-value crops are grown, not like in Iowa where we have mechanized wheat, etc. These are high-labor crops, and it's basically the economy are these enormous plantations. Workers are, crew masters to keep track of workers actually have to be in airplanes and fly over them. They're so extensive. And prisons and plantations are what these, so there's not much life, and it's very poor, very bad school systems.
We did a show on child labor throughout the world, and it's pretty bad in certain places like Indonesia and the United States, California mostly. Mm-hmm. So kids are working in the fields, and we brought up the whole matter of pesticides. And you describe your own experience encountering pesticides in the fields. I'm always surprised. I always thought pesticide use was closely regulated.
Well, it's supposed to be closely regulated, but it's not. And, the San Joaquin Valley, this is green, and California, which is, supposedly high environmental consciousness, but this is the most polluted area in the United States, and a lot of that is because of pesticides. Because there are pickers, they're extremely exposed to wind, and pesticides are used for mandarins, for all those clementines that we buy in those plastic in those little netted bags and boxes that we love. Those are all grown in California, all with tremendous millions of pounds of pesticides.
Do they at least wear gloves when they're doing the picking?
In 115 degree heat, not only do they wear gloves, they wear hats. They wear two or three sweatshirts, two pairs of pants, heavy socks and boots to protect themselves precisely against pesticides.
You write that the immigrant families in the San Joaquin Valley live in terror of la migra.
Mm-hmm. La migra is ice, the immigrant.
So they call it la migra, the migrant. Immigration.
Yeah.
Authorities.
Yeah, la migra, and la migra is the enemy, the devil. It's almost a paramilitary group acting.
Was it all that way before Trump? Because you remember, I'm sure, that Barack Obama was very unhappy when somebody labeled him the deporter in chief.
Yeah, and he did preside over a lot of deportation. It's true, but it wasn't People were not hunted in the workplace or at the, or in their homes. People were taken out if they had committed crime. So it was a different. He did a lot of sort of low level crime commissions that for deportation, but he never terrorized or allowed the federal forces to terrorize individual communities.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. What got you thinking about even writing these articles?
Well, originally the idea was before the November election to go to California and see the lay of the land and write what the election results would likely be. California had 13 or 14 seats that could be swung, and it seemed to have the most. But I found that to be less interesting than actually what was going on the ground. Mm-hmm. Yes, California has played a huge role in or its part at least, in flipping Congress to the Democrats, but that was less interesting.
But were you surprised that so many Republicans wound up losing often what were considered safe seats? Only a few held on to their seats. Devin Nunes, who people thought was endangered, he wound up winning.
He wound up winning, and Kevin McCarthy, who was also a fanatical Trumpist, who was the majority leader, also won. So we have to remember both Californians, both strong Trumpists. So it's not the table is not completely Democratic. But I was surprised. Yes, I was surprised in Orange County, for instance, Katie Porter, a Elizabeth Warren Democrat, who was a consumer advocate, who taught at the University of Irvine California in Irvine, beat Mimi Walters, a moderate entrenched Republican. So that was a surprise.
California is the third largest state in area, but don't needs vary drastically from one region to another in a way that often isn't the case in other states? I would think Ohio is kind of like that as well, where in the north you have Cleveland, in the south you're bordering on Kentucky and Appalachia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a state like that where it's separate parts, and also it's mountains. It's very isolated culturally, the different parts. The north is very Republican, very conservative, gun rights. You see Make America Great Again hats everywhere in the north.
When you say the north, you're talking about near the border with Oregon? Because by the time you get to San Francisco, you're in a very different place.
Yeah, I guess the far north, all the way down to Sacramento, I would say, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. That's hundreds of miles.
Is there a rural-urban divide in California as there is between city and state here in New York City?
Yeah, there's an east-west divide, I would say. The east being the coast. The coast is expensive. The coast is privileged. The coast has better schools. The coast has a different culture. And east of the five, as they say, east of the coast ranges, the mountains that are called the coastal ranges, I think, is poorer and drier and more parched and just more difficult to live.
The Bureau of Economic Analysis reports that California has a $2.9 trillion economy, or had it in 2017. And I guess most people would assume that it's mostly in agriculture because so much of so many of the agricultural products that we eat even here come from California. But how does it compare to finance and real estate and high tech?
Probably high. You know, the total revenues from in 2018, they've just released figures for agriculture was a little over 50 billion, which is quite a bit. I mean,
it's 2% of the state's GDP.
Yeah.
That's very small then.
Yeah. Tech is what's made California. Google, Facebook, Netflix, Apple. This is what has made California the fifth wealthiest economy in the world.
Well, now that Amazon is moving part of its operation to New York, maybe we'll catch up. Despite their liberal positions on many social issues, aren't a number of Democrats more conservative on economic issues like organized labor or big money? Kamala Harris was criticized for not bringing a legal action when she was the California Attorney General against Steve Mnuchin and One West Bank.
Yeah. I mean, the old interests of the Bay Area, where she was prosecutor in Alameda County, which includes Oakland and I think maybe part of San Francisco and Berkeley. It's very difficult to come up against those economic forces, and she was rightfully criticized. She had to play ball with what she had. You know, it's interesting because California, in the Bay Area, there is really a machine that we would recognize in New York as a kind of a political machine. You see, all the important figures that come out of California that are national figures are from the Bay Area. You have Governor Gavin Newsom from San Francisco. You have Jerry Brown from Oakland, Kamala Harris from the Bay Area, Nancy Pelosi from San Francisco. So they
not Los Angeles.
No,
Los Angeles is the bigger city.
Yeah, but it doesn't create political stars. It's interesting.
I wonder if it's because Los Angeles is really the equivalent of a lot of small towns rather than one big city. Whereas San Francisco, you do feel like you're in an integrated city.
That's right. That's right. San Francisco, we recognize as New Yorkers, we recognize San Francisco. But L.A. is a whole different animal. And also, L.A. is so crazy because you have L.A. County, so you have Santa Monica's a separate city. It's not part of Los Angeles. And all these little things in the middle that have declared themselves city, Beverly Hills, mm-hmm. has decoupled itself from Los Angeles. So you have an area of 10 million people, Los Angeles County, but the city of Los Angeles is only slightly under 4 million.
But are the suburbs of San Francisco, like Walnut Creek, the Marin County suburbs, are they also similar to San Francisco? Or do we have the similar kind of situation that we might have here where when you go to Westchester, you're going to a different kind of place?
Yeah. Marin County, is we would say, would be a little bit like Chappaqua or something. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
New York State spends 84 cents for every dollar that California spends, even though New York has fewer than half the people. So California must be neglecting something. Or is it, as you said earlier, it just isn't collecting as many taxes as New York State?
Well, yeah, it has a much, much more vulnerable tax base than New York. Much, much more vulnerable to recession and its property taxes. That is the problem with California, is that they have frozen property taxes. They must have 15 to 20 million homeowning households. Mm-hmm. This is paying almost no property tax.
What about the impact and influence of wealthy workers at companies like Facebook and Google in areas like San Francisco?
Well, they're resented, especially in Oakland, because they're driving up housing costs. But it's not their fault. You know, the average, because they have to have somewhere to live. They can't live in the valley. The average, I think it's Facebook worker makes 240,000. Google, the average Google worker in California makes $240,000 a year. Facebook's 200,000.
Gee, I wish I were more tech oriented. parts of California, of course, as we saw this year, had massive wildfires in 2008. And most people are agreeing, except some people in Washington, that climate change is the reason. Is climate change the biggest threat to the state?
Well, California is always on the edge of an apocalypse. It really is. The gestalt of the state is so much different than the rest of the country because, yes, you have the wildfires, which have really raged out of control, and even in Malibu and on the coast, they've hit. You have the threat of an earthquake. You have long, serious droughts and water problems. So California lives with this idea and this sense, this innate sense of the coming apocalypse.
And drought, of course, is a real problem for an agricultural state.
Yeah.
How have they gotten around it until now?
They cheat. They steal water. They buy water underground. There's a black market in water. So the San Joaquin Valley, which has very little rainfall, has a system of pipes underneath it that if everyone took an X-ray of the ground, it would be quite extraordinary.
Is that what's called the Central Valley of California?
That's the Central Valley is also the Northern, and San Joaquin is part of the Central Valley, and then up along where Sacramento, north of Sacramento, is also the Central Valley.
Now, the president blamed California for its wildfires. It said that its policies were responsible, suggested more raking might be an appropriate approach. But how is that turning Californians off, the fact that that Washington seems to be at war with California, even with things like that?
I think Californians are proud of it. I think
that they're at war, like automobile emissions and things like that?
Very proud of it. There's a lot of pride on this. California doesn't see itself as separate from the United States. It sees itself as the avatar, the future of the United States. So it has a very strong feeling of itself as the compass for the country. And this is widespread, not just with politicians, you know, just regular folk.
They were ahead of the rest of the country. Well, but I remember the first time I went to Los Angeles, and you could see the air. This was in the early 60s. They had no choice but to start trying to worry about automobile emissions and the like.
Yeah, I mean, they had no public transportation. They were growing exponentially. So a lot of the problem, L.A. was the sort of matrix and model city for what's become the cities of the world. Mexico City, these spread out cities, some of the African cities, some of the Asian cities that just spread. So, you know, its solutions can be used as world solutions because it's automobile. It was an automobile dependent, as we know, place, and it has to change its culture, and it's in the process of doing this. And I think its political leadership sees this and is trying to get people to change their culture and the car culture. They're building out a tremendous amount of and spending a lot of money on public transportation, but people don't use it. You know, it's funny. You're in L.A., and if you get on the public transportation, no one's on it.
Some poor people.
Yeah, poor people who don't have cars. People who don't have cars, but not people who do have cars that are using it instead of being blocked in traffic. And that's the idea that has to turn.
I had a conversation with somebody who's living in one of the artsy neighborhoods of Los Angeles, where all the actors live. And he said, we have 20 coffee houses near us, but we don't have one supermarket.
Right.
And he realized that this was a major problem that was caused by gentrification, but also perhaps by the whole culture of the area.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, when I was staying in Santa Monica, I had the most expensive cup of coffee. I came out in the morning, and it was something like an $11 cup of coffee, and people were lined up for it. And it was presented as some kind of gourmet, chemical, magical, alchemist thing. And so there's a lot of fetish. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fetish around taste, wine, coffee. California can be very annoying in this way, yeah.
On the other hand, California is a major wine producer, one of the most important in the world. Mm-hmm. So they have something to be proud of. But I'm wondering, okay, so you've written these two articles, which pretty much lay out a case for changing things. California, as wonderful as it can be, is a troubled state. Are these things being discussed in the state legislature?
Yes.
Do they come up when people are running for office?
Yes. Housing is the issue in California, and it's really in the throes of a passionate debate about what to do about its housing problem.
Can't the cities just, I mean, we have our own problems with NYCHA housing here, but still, can't the city the various cities build housing for poor people?
Well, if only they could. And not just for
Well, they can't people. Because they can't afford it because of taxation?
And also just moderate income people who can't afford homes. Not poor and moderate income people making 50, 60,000 teachers, et cetera. No, they can't because there's a lot of local control. Take Berkeley, for instance. Berkeley is one of the most progressive, traditionally, cities in the country, if not the most. In 1973, it passed a visionary ordinance that was meant to stop urban renewal, quote unquote. This idea of remaking cities and trashing cities and federal money coming in and rebuilding cities.
You mean knocking down the older housing
down,
stock and
right.
putting up new stuff.
Right. And that ordinance, it was very revolutionary at the time, very progressive, and it meant that local neighborhood residents had complete control over housing. Today, that ordinance is used to stop any kind of housing, except for in the downtown area where they've rezoned for one-bedroom apartments for Berkeley students of various high moderate income. The average home in Berkeley is $1 million. The average one-bedroom apartment is $2,300. And they will not build affordable housing.
But we're seeing something similar right here in Brooklyn. There's a major building boom in downtown Brooklyn, and studio apartments are going for $1 million.
Yeah.
So is this the way of America, or is this the way of just... And New York is also considered one of the more progressive parts of the country.
I think it's the way of the chosen cities. Seattle, Boston,
Brooklyn
New
Brooklyn has become a place people want to live. In the past, it was cheaper because people didn't want to live there.
Yeah, the wealthy cities. And it's going to become more so that with Amazon, of course, and it's the financial center. So it's a city that produces jobs. And it's a city where people want to be, and so there is a dichotomy. I mean, if Amazon had settled in Detroit or Cleveland, it would make more sense in terms of redistributing regional wealth in the United States. But that's not happening. Wealth is continuing to agglomerate in places like New York, L.A., San Francisco, and so yeah, in a way, it's the way of the country. But remember, New York, for however much we might criticize it, and I have criticized it in the pages of the New York Review, has an affordable housing policy that is run by de Blasio that really is creating tens of thousands of affordable homes. Now, they're not enough. Some people say they're too expensive, but there's a lot of incentive to build. So there's a huge amount of building in New York. And right now, there's a glut of apartments. So 5 years ago, there was a housing crisis that has eased a bit just because there's been a glut of development. And some of that's affordable. Some of it isn't. Some of it's market rate. But even market rate rents are beginning to drop. So you have a high supply in New York. There's no housing shortage in New York. There's a shortage of affordable housing. In California, there's a shortage of housing, period.
Despite the fact that there's so much land mass.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, you'd think that somebody would, real estate developers would see this as an opportunity to make some money. They can do buildings on the cheap. Is the cost of land too high?
Well, the cost of land is high, but developers would love to build more, and it's very interesting.
Oh, they're being restrained by local ordinances.
Yes, but they want to build market rate. They want to. So what's interesting is in criticizing the old left slow growth anti-development movement of California, which was a progressive movement in the 70s, 80s. Tom Hayden was a big proponent, no growth environment. In criticizing that, I run the risk of sounding like I'm pro-development. But we're in the year 2019, and the problems are different, and conservation and development don't have to be at odds. And this is where California can lead the country.
California also has a problem that it's been a magnet for people all from all other parts of the country, not just immigrants. But I was looking at songs to play on today's show, and there are three or four about I want to go to California. Or, of course, the Mamas and the Papas had a famous song about being stuck in the East when California is just so much more pleasant.
California dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On such a winter's day.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I'm sure there are many people here, right here in New York, who are thinking along those lines. But it's caught in a bind then, because on the one hand, people want to go there. Mm-hmm. And I suspect California has thrived because people have gone there, have been attracted to it. And yet, it's not providing housing for those people.
And it's not growing anymore. It's not attracting people. In fact, it's losing a lot of people. I think the growth rate for California was less than 1%, which is barely death and birth. So this is a new reality for California.
And what's going to happen to those people who've been burned out of their homes?
God, I don't know.
New York, Texas, and Florida are large states with high percentages of unauthorized immigrants. Have you looked into how California compares with those states?
Well, California is protects them, which Texas doesn't, through its sanctuary laws. And it doesn't allow ICE to go into workplaces and demand lists of undocumented workers. So actually, California employers are also in favor of California sanctuary laws. So that's different than Texas. Minimum wage is going to grow to $15 by 2022, and they demand minimum wage for everyone. Hotel workers have to make $15. A lot of them are undocumented. So that's different. Texas, I think minimum wage is what, seven something?
Hmm. Very low.
Yeah.
But according to the Economic Policy Institute, California is the seventh most unequal state. Of course, New York State is number one. Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta organized farm workers in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. How is the organization of farm workers faring these days?
Well, they're having a slight uptick because the immigration policies have caused a worker shortage. They need 400,000 hands to harvest those grapes, those table grapes and the lettuce, etc. Almost all of those people come from southern Mexico, from the poorer regions of Mexico, Oaxaca, Mixteco people. If anyone saw the movie Roma, the woman who plays the domestic servant is a Mixteca woman. And that's exactly the group that's all over the San Joaquin Valley, really hardworking people, really good people. Because
there's no opportunity for them in Mexico, or little.
Especially in southern Mexico. Central Mexico and northern Mexico is more industrialized. People don't want to take the risk of coming in. So there's a shortage, partly because of Trump's laws.
Haven't conservatives in the judiciary, including on the Supreme Court, consistently ruled against labor in recent years? How has immigrant labor fared in the court system?
In California State?
Yeah.
Mixed. It depends on the particular judge, of course. But they've fared pretty well.
Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, Michael Greenberg. His articles, In the Valley of Fear, appeared in the December 20th issue of the New York Review of Books, and California, the State of Resistance, was in the January 17th issue.
Thanks, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Michael Greenberg, to Hugh Sansom, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Located at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.